Hello. Welcome to the Michael Harding Podcast. I'm sitting here in the hills above Loch Allen. It's a beautiful day. There was a storm last night, Storm Babette. And people are suffering all over the country in Ireland at the moment. And if you're one of them, my heart goes out to you. I hope you survive and I hope your house, your business hasn't been ruined. These things are terrible. And maybe, I suppose, you might find some distraction in listening to this podcast. There's also something really more dark going on in the world at the moment, and that's in the Middle East. The unspeakable pornographic violence of the past 2 weeks is just hard to talk about. And in some sense, I don't know how to talk about it. I can't talk about it. In some sense, even, do you know the way people would look at it and see two religions fighting each other and they'd say, well, obviously, time to give up religion. To my mind, it's time to start doing religion properly because you don't get rid of it. Religion is always going to be there as a kind of an aspect of humanity. It's a kind of an intrinsic, basic aspect of human behaviour. And if it's done badly, look what you get. So wouldn't it be a good idea actually to move, as Teilhard de Chardin used to say, from an age of religions to an age of religion? And that was his prediction, that we would move into an age of religion. You know, that we would begin to see that religion is actually an essential part of being human. An essential part of being fulfilled and awoke as a good human being. And so we would try and find a way, comparatively, one religion to another to understand how similar they are, how they're all containing, holding the same wisdom of what it means to be human. And that we would practice it well. And that for me certainly would mean, you know, that I can enjoy and be enriched by the practices of Tibetan Buddhism or listening to wonderful people like A. Helwa when she's reading on audiobooks wisdom from Islam. But it also means that in my singular little world, I find I rest in the presence of God and in Jesus. That's my simple. It's not like, I'm almost ashamed of it. You know something? I'm nearly ashamed of it. It's so simple. It's so childish. You know, that in a time of such sophistication and everybody's become so modern and analysed society in ways that are contradictory to Christianity, ways that seem to undermine Christianity. Like if you look at, you know, what modern society should be in all its inclusiveness, the one thing you wouldn't want to include would be Christianity because they're all, you know, misogynistic and patriarchal and all the rest of it. Now that's the negative view of Christianity. That's the extreme view. It's not really like that. People's hearts are still open to the mystery of love. And the mystery of love is a metaphysical experience. It's never just physical. It's never just physical. It is transcendent. And it is, you know, people said, you know, the silence is the voice of God. The language of God is silence. And you know it, I know it, when you are still and calm, when you rest and meditate or be alone in a church or whatever, you find peace. When you are alone, you find peace. It's amazing. So that would impel me to kind of try and practice religion better so that me being exclusively Christian is a way that I'm deeply embracing my brothers and sisters who are Hindu, Muslim, Christian or Jew, no matter what. And so that's all I can do in relation to the darkness that has again erupted. It's in the Middle East and you can follow it on the radio, on the television, on the internet. You can have a feed of it 24 hours a day, hatred and violence and the destruction of human life. It's quite extraordinary. And the amount of technology that we've built up to kill other human beings, the amount of technology we have to dismember human bodies is extraordinary. What do you do? I have no way, I'm not going to start talking about it now, don't worry. All I'm saying is that all I can do is pray. All I can do is try and practice my sense of calm abiding with the Christian icon and try and practice it a little bit more intensely. That's all. That's all. Maybe a naive thing to do, but that's all. And so for the podcast this week, I thought rather than be heavy about anything, I would do the opposite and just have a bit of fun. And so I'm going to share with you, if it's okay, 3, 4, 5, as many as I can put in, just reflections, meditations that are kind of a bit of fun. The first one I want to share with you is about a time, it's a good few years ago now. It could be 15 years ago, and I was in, you know, I had membership to a leisure centre in the local hotel, and I wrote this. I met God only once, in the steam room of my local leisure centre, or at least I met the divine male, the perfect embodiment of masculine hubris. He was young and tall, and a white towel was all he had casually wrapped around his waist. He sat on the bench enveloped in fog and drew one of his legs up to his chest so that the towel became a veil that might be torn asunder at any moment to reveal something terrible. At least that's what it felt like, sitting opposite him, me with my wrinkled limbs and enormous pot belly. Then a young woman entered and almost slipped on the tiles when she saw his towel. She spread herself on the bench near to him, her legs stretched in the direction of the god, and she lay back and started talking, compulsively, as if she needed to, or was obliged to, or had been ordered to by some official at reception, with the words, "Will you go in there and humour that god in case he eats us all alive?" She asked him where he was from. "Russia," he replied. "And how are you enjoying Ireland?" "It is a pity. It is raining." "Oh, but last week we had sunshine," she declared. "All the time." "Well, all day, of course. I mean, not all night. Ha ha, silly me." She laughed, but he didn't seem amused. "The sun also in Russia last week, but also sometimes rain," he muttered. He was losing interest. "Is that a fact?" she said. "That's fascinating." Then he looked at me as if I too might be a god. "How are you enjoying Ireland?" he inquired. "Actually, I'm Irish," I confessed. The woman stretched on the bench beside me rose and shook herself like a twig, shaking off raindrops, and she left the room. I think I was irritating her. My presence was ruining any possibilities she might have with his lordship. So she left me and the male god alone in the steam. He looked at me closely through the fog, and he said, "I did not think you were Irish," with such intensity that I felt nervous. I said, "I've only been to Russia once. I was en route to Mongolia, but they kept me in the airport transit area because I didn't have a visa. A bit like Andrew Snowden," I added with a chuckle. But he didn't laugh. He said, "I came from Russia in a helicopter. I stopped over in many places, and last Tuesday I was in London, and I was talking to a friend. Said Ireland was beautiful, so I decided to come over." In your helicopter? Of course. You have it with you? Of course. He's outside the door. Then the woman returned. She had a towel with her this time, and it was tied around her waist like a skirt. Fortunately, she still had her swimming costume on, but the towel was a definite indication that she wished to emulate his style, and perhaps even be absorbed by him, and become one with God. She lay down on the bench again. He stretched the leg that had been up to his chest, and then raised the other leg up so that the towel, which was now a dripping rag in the street steam, left his groin even more exposed. And the sense of intensity I felt between the human woman and the divine male was so extreme that I had to leave the room before I fainted. I sat in the jacuzzi for a while, which is always cool in the morning, and it calmed me down. Later, as I was leaving, I saw the actual helicopter. It was just, as he said, outside the main entrance to the hotel. I wanted to go up and touch it, because I hadn't, of course, dared touch the god's body, for fear he might misconstrue my sexual orientation, or for fear the lady stretched before him might scream, "Leave him alone, he's mine." But I didn't touch the helicopter either. I went home and had tea with some Rivita and a boiled egg. And by the time I had reached the dregs of the tea and was outside gazing at the lake, I heard him. The buzzing of the chopper came to me first, and then a few moments later I saw the craft in the sky above me, moving slowly over the roof, and then across the lake towards Fermanagh. But I could not tell if the human woman was with him, or if he was all alone up there in the clouds. And to tell you the truth now, I couldn't believe it myself. This fella saying he had a helicopter outside the door, and I couldn't believe. How could he have come from Russia? It's too far away. So I will never know. All I know is that that's what he told me, and he said it is the truth. And maybe it is, if he took 3 or 4 or 5 days and went a little bit each day, he could move from Russia to here. And why would he be here? I used to wonder. Because, you know, thinking about James Bond and spies is silly. And there was no other reason I could imagine that he would be around these parts of Leitrim until maybe 5 or 6 years later, when I realised that there were certain businessmen in this part of the country who had huge assets in Russia, in Petersburg, and in other East European countries, like hundreds of millions of euros worth of assets in Eastern Europe and in Russia. And then I thought, my goodness, sure, of course, there might easily have been some enormously rich multimillionaire doing business deals and coming in a helicopter. So there you go. I suppose it's also about me getting old. You know, that little reflection is about how you're looking at a young male who's powerful as well as young, you know, like he's beautiful, he's strong, his physique is perfect, and he has a helicopter outside the door. You can't get much better than that. Like, I mean, when we were going to dances in Leitrim in the ballroom of Romance in Glenfarn in the 1970s, you might be competing with a guard, you know. There'd be some girl, some woman that you wanted to dance with. You'd be hoping you might, as they used to say in those days, you're hoping you might get off with her. You'd be desiring her greatly, hugely. And then you'd see a guard You'd always know the guards in those days. They'd be kind of wearing sort of Dunstore slacks, trousers that you call slacks, grey, with kind of razor blade creases. And they'd be wearing jumpers. Jumpers, like, again, that had come out of Dunstores. And you just know them from a million miles away that they were guards off duty. And the girls had known that too. And the girls had no, you know, they weren't fools in the ballroom of romance. You know, a man with a good income, permanent and pensionable. That was a fair prize in them days too, when everybody was poor. So, like, you were competing with that sometimes when you'd go dancing and you were hoping to, you know, get off with somebody. But, I mean, that wasn't a big competition if you compare it to a fellow with a helicopter. And who looked like he looked. Which is also an extraordinary thing, that in those days, young men in the West, or certainly in Ireland, they didn't do much gym work. And so if you saw one of these guys with their muscles toned up to, like, bronze, you'd know that they weren't Irish. That's a funny thing to say. I suppose if you walk around Ireland now, you'll find young men who have gone down that path and who look like that. And fair play to them, if that's what keeps them happy. But certainly, I never met anybody like him. In his kind of... And he was naked. I mean, he was naked except for a towel. And he wasn't bothered about... You know, they were divine testicles he had in there. So he wasn't worried. It was like you had to take responsibility not to be looking at him. You had to, and you'd keep your eyes to the ground, even in the steam. You know, you'd be afraid that if you stared at him too much, he'd actually stare back and say, "What are you looking at?" And as I say, I got out and went to the steam, or I went to the jacuzzi. Now, the funny thing is, when I say that, I realise, God, it's been years since I was in a jacuzzi. And so there's a double take for me. When I initially wrote that piece, I was reflecting on the prowess of a beautiful young male. Now, I'm even reflecting on the prowess of me. Because the things that I was doing in those days, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I was going swimming. I was going into jacuzzis, I was going into steam rooms. I don't do those things now. Sorry to say, probably should be doing them at 70 years of age. Why wouldn't you be doing them? But, you know, with health issues, one thing and another. There's also, I would say, if to be honest, there's a kind of a shame can come upon you as you get old, because it's hard sometimes to deal with ageing in a physical way. And that goes for men as well as women. So maybe it's something that men don't admit to. You know, that they can have quite a lot of psychological trouble around the moment when they're looking in the mirror on their own after having a shower in the morning, and they look and they see, God, this body is falling apart. And that can bring them a sense of shame, or a sense of kind of, it knocks back your pride, knocks back your sense of yourself. So that's okay. That's okay. Maybe that's how prayer and faith become stronger the older you get. And maybe that's wisdom. I don't know. I'll go on to read another reflection. And this is also about the body. It's about two bodies, really. It's a moment that happened in COVID. And one body is the body of a young man in death, and the other is the body of a bee in death. I suppose this is a very Buddhist reflection, because it was my teacher one time, you know, said to me, I said, like, what's the significance of killing a fly? And he would say that the fly's life is as important to the fly as your life is to you. So they're actually the same. We'd have a tendency to think, like, my life is very important, and it would be very wrong to kill a human being. But the life of the fly, come on. But to the fly, his life or her life is as important within the context of how they experience life. Their life may be infinitesimally more simple or smaller. You know, as a mechanism, as an organism, they're just such a simple thing. But to the extent that they are conscious, then they are conscious that they're losing their life. A woman told me recently that her son died in New York from COVID-19. This is about 2-3 years ago. He had no funeral and nobody at the cremation. And so she would never know the details of his final days. Imagine that. Like, that was the beginning of COVID. We had no vaccines. No vaccine had been developed. And at the beginning of it, nobody knew how bad it was going to be. Maybe it would wipe out the whole world or something. We didn't know. And there was a huge spike of deaths in New York at one stage. And they were losing control as to how to bury them. You know, there were bodies being kept outside hospitals in ambulances and things. So her son died out there at that time. She couldn't go out. She couldn't go out. Can you believe it? In this day and age, that happened 3 years ago. And there was no funeral. And there was nobody at the cremation. And she would never know the details of his final days. "My heart is broken," she said. "The pain of losing him is unbearable." Apparently, he was in a body bag and the coffin was sealed. Says she to me, "What an end to the child we loved so much." Although she was standing before me, I knew that her mind was elsewhere. Grief and bereavement are desolate places, locations in the darkest recesses of the soul. Places to where a person must travel sometimes. And I knew she was gone there. That's the way I think about grief. Grief is a kind of it's a place you have to go sometimes. It's like you have to get an airline ticket. You have to kind of metaphorically go to it. You're still walking around. You're still being looked at by your friends and neighbours, but you're gone somewhere. You're somewhere else. You're in the land of grief. "Say a prayer for me," she said. And not wanting to get entangled in semantics, I said, "Yes, of course I will." But the holiday came and I forgot about her. It was Christmas. And then in the new year, I returned to my studio shed one day. Now, as a writer, I've made a commodity out of my life. You know, my emotions are public. My persona is recognised on the street. But the real me remains hidden behind the curtains of my studio, where Tibetan bells tingle and incense soothes me, as I imagine various deities in the candlelight, Buddha, Christ, and angels from the Quran or the Torah, all mixing together in a menagerie of divine bliss. I love this studio. I'm in it now. And sometimes I act out little rituals when no one else can see me, as I try to enter the ontological here and now that Thich Nhat Hanh advocates. The here and now. Like the here and now is the trick. That's all I have to preach. That's all I have to share. That's all the wisdom I have after 70 years. Here and now. Be here. Be here, be now. Here. And what I say there is I try to enter the ontological here and now. Because because this is really the point. When you open this door through meditation or mindfulness or prayer or whatever, and you come into sort of being present to yourself, being present to the mystery, you kind of experience and you quieten the mind, and then there's this silence comes. It's ontological. There's a threshold you slip over and you realize the ground of being, something outside you, is touching you. This is not from within your own psyche. This is not from within the dynamic of your own body or mind. As probably all psychology, psychiatry of the 20th century would suggest. But it's not. That's the ontological threshold, if you believe in it. It's, or if you experience it. It's a moment in silence of experience where you just know you're not alone. And I mean, you're not alone. And that's why I love my studio, because it's my little shed or my cave, my hermitage. And here I can be alone to experience not being alone. And I enter the ontological here and now. When I opened the door 3 years ago after Christmas, I opened the door and I was going to begin the new year, and I found a bee, little bee, stretched on the floor. And I hovered over him and I gazed at his little legs and I wondered if he had been stressed when he died. Or did his consciousness dissolve into the night like the smoke of a quenched candle? A Tibetan teacher once told me that bees experience death in the context of how they have experienced life. And in that sense, they are the same as other beings. Death is always profound, is the idea. So even the tiny little bee, tiny little life, tiny little simplicity, but for that bee, the measure of what he is losing in death is the totality of the life, all life. His entire cosmos is annihilated, and he is nothing. Even though we're a higher being, you know, with more complex form, organistically, even though our consciousness is far more sophisticated, perhaps, our annihilation in death is 100%. We lose everything. We lose our cosmos. We lose everything. It's all gone. There's nothing, because there's no me. Gone. But relatively, the bee is also precious. That's what my Tibetan teacher told me. And that's why the Buddhists have this great respect for don't kill life, don't kill sentient beings. Treat all sentient beings as worthy and capable ultimately of enlightenment. You might say that's very different from the Christian thing that we just center on the human, but if you look back at early Christian theologians, you find that they were all talking about reincarnation. And if you look at the lives of wonderful saints in Ireland in the 6th, 7th, 8th century, there's beautiful stories about, like, they're poetic stories, they're imaginative ways of talking about the communion between humans and animals. But they still, nonetheless, obviously are treating animals as having potential, and their souls having potential, and the possibility of reincarnation being real. Just read St. Francis of Assisi. Read some of the stories about his rapport with animals, and you get that lovely embrace of all sentient beings. Or think about people like, do you remember, what saint was it that he was praying with his arms outstretched, and the church was so narrow that the hands were outside the window, and he was there so long that a bird made a nest in one of his hands, and then he had to wait until the bird had its brood before he could move the nest. That they're poetic expressions of some deep rapport and connection between us. Anyway, get back to the bee. The bee was on the floor, and it evoked in me a strange sorrow as I sat at the computer, although I couldn't focus on the work because I was thinking of the bee. And I wanted to do something for the bee. I wasn't going to read the entire Tibetan Book of the Dead for him, but I did sit with my back straight for a few moments in the pose of a wise practitioner, and I allowed my body to fall into calm abiding. Single-minded, hoping that that calm would be appropriate as a mark of farewell, not just to him, but to all sentient beings who had passed away on that day. I'd say do it sometimes, you know. I'd say try it. You know, you see, it's meditation, but it's not necessarily just meditation like trying to, you know, be aware of yourself. Oh, look, your subjective mind, as Robert Thurman says, your subjective mind is chasing your subjective mind. You're trying to become aware of your mind with your mind. And it's like a dog chasing its tail. You can never get there. There's another image they have is like a diamond drill, that it's like you start spinning. Your consciousness is kind of spinning around from one thing to another because you're trying to be conscious of your consciousness. Anyway, there's another simple way of meditation, and that is to make the focus not all the sort of emotions and ideas that are flying through your brain, but just pick somebody else. You can pick a candle. That's an obvious one. People do that. You know, you light the candle and just focus on the flame. And the most obvious one is focusing on your breath. Another one is focusing on an icon. But another one, a beautiful one, is to focus on somebody who's at a huge, important moment in their life. Now, there's no moment more important than death. Last week, I was talking about my neighbour, this beautiful woman who passed away. Now, if I stop for a moment and remember her, like I remember her with my heart, I can nearly feel that my heart is conscious in this posture. And I'm wishing her well, like, may light of heaven shine upon her, I say. Okay. That's a beautiful thing to do. That's a beautiful meditation that expands your mind in ways that are absolutely fantastic, to pray for the dead. And nobody kind of sometimes, nobody thinks that. Nobody realizes that when we go into November now in the next 3 weeks, it's like a time of remembering the dead. And apart from any theological views you might have about that, as a meditation practice, it is superb. It will draw you into calm abiding very strongly, very deeply, very clearly. Because you're remembering people who you love, and you're thinking about them in death, which is the biggest thing can ever happen. And there will be fear around that, and wonder and uncertainty. And you're saying, may the light of heaven be upon them. And just doing that, just saying those words, when you're bringing to mind, I bring to mind my mother, my father, my uncle, loads of people close to me. And I say, may the light of heaven be upon them. That's a beautiful meditation. It has a dynamic that affects your tranquility, your calm abiding in the present moment. It's just huge. And then if you add to that, if you feel like it, all sentient beings. It could be an animal you loved. You're not contravening any theological truth or regulation. You know, you're just wishing that the immeasurable light of heaven would be indwelling in every sentient being. That the whole cosmos would be transformed by love. And so those ideas that you get in you know, religious prayerfulness, techniques of prayer within the Christian tradition, they're hugely valuable at a human level to help you feel better because you're in a sense of deep meditation. And, okay, that's why I genuinely, after the Christmas holidays, I come back and I find here's a little fella lying on the floor, little bee. And I can't concentrate. I'm sitting at the computer trying to write. I can't. I'm thinking of the little fella on the floor. I looked out the window towards Quilca Mountain, knowing that my Tibetan teacher lives on the other side, and I whispered to him for help. It's another way of prayer. So, in reality, he lives maybe 40 minutes away across the mountain. Maybe at this moment, even now, maybe he's over there sitting in a room looking out a window. So he can't hear me. And I'm whispering. But I still whisper, invoking his help. And that again is like a meditation. It does something healthy to my body and to my consciousness. And I know many people do this and have this relationship with loved ones who have passed away. The woman who speaks to her husband, who, you know, he's departed, he's passed away, and yet she said to me one time, there's not a day goes by but we don't speak. We all do this. What we probably miss sometimes, or forget, is how beneficial it is to mental health to have that huge expanse in your consciousness that reaches out to the entire universe and reaches out beyond the present moment and takes everything into the present moment. So it's like there's these light rays, if you like, in Buddhist imagery, it's as if there were light rays going out from your heart, 1,000 rays of light going out from your heart and going out to the ends of the universe with little hooks on them. And they can hook up people who are suffering or people who are in pain, and they can pull them back into your heart. That's a lovely image of it. So with all that kind of stuff going on in my head, in my life, you can imagine I'm trying to sit at the computer screen and write, and I'm being distracted by the little, tiny little bee on the floor. And then I'm sort of thinking about my teacher, and I'm saying, help me, please help me. And then, because maybe he did, maybe in some way by just saying, please help me, my mind opened to all the possibilities that my teacher, my Lama, what would he do? So I lifted up the bee on a piece of newspaper, and I opened the door of the stove, and I committed his little body to the flames, which devoured him with a tiny noise, like cellophane paper crumbling. It was impossible to write anything after that, and I feared my impromptu funeral ritual might be a sign that I was once again verging on depression, especially since this was the beginning of January. January is a dangerous month for people who are inclined towards melancholy. But what liberated me from depression 10 years ago was the simple practice of mindfulness and prayer. The practice of clinging to my inward and outward breath, for example, watching the breath, it was as if it were a life raft, until I became confident enough to know that I could float in the world again. It's not that mindfulness felt like prayer in the old-fashioned sense, but I remember once describing it to a therapist as dissolving into the present moment and melting into the empty space where God used to be. And then gradually I realized that dissolving into the present moment, yes. Melting into the empty space where God used to be, yes. And then the threshold. Then the threshold where you realize that space is where God abides. That space that is empty, that space that is silent. This is God. This is not an emptiness from whence God has fled. No. This is actually communication. You're getting the message. If you get over that threshold, I think you're in a wonderful space. I really do. I suppose it's no wonder, it's when you hear me talking like this, it's no wonder that my studio here has become my refuge. It has become such a refuge because it's where I'm alone and where I can experience this solitude and where within the solitude I can experience communion. So there I was, absorbed in calm abiding. The fragility of the bee's life led me to remember the woman who lost her son, and then I recalled her and prayed for her and prayed for her son. I recalled again her grief and devastation over the body who was wrapped in a body bag and coffined so far away from her. And I thought too that it's strange how the universe works. The dead bee allowed me to enter a space where the woman was. You know that space I talked about, like a far off land. It's a place you nearly have to get an aeroplane and go to it, and you're still going around. You know, you're still beside your friends and relations, and they're looking at you. But you're it's like you're somewhere else. You're gone to another country because you are in grief. And it allowed me, the little dead bee, accidentally allowed me to get to where she was, to visit that country for a moment. And to sit with her in her place of desolation. And that's a little like prayer. When I get to that space for somebody else who has departed, and I say, may the light of heaven to them. In my meditation, I'm bringing them into that present moment. The woman in grief, or anybody. Think about it. Think about you doing it with anybody, because your narrative will be different. There will be people that are grieving in your life. There will be people suffering in your life. And you can bring them in when you meditate. You can bring them in and say, may the light of heaven be with them. That you are praying. You're sending out these amazing rays of light to the ends of the earth and then the ends of the universe, and they're hooking anybody who's in pain, any sentient being who's in pain, and you're drawing them into your own heart, and in the heart, it's your heart speaking when you say the words, may the light of heaven be with them. And that's the best I can suggest in relation to what's going on in the Middle East. The war, the hatred, the violence, the fear, the anger, the terrible destruction, the machines invented to tear the limbs off human beings. Never mind the limbs of a little bee, but like devising as we do machines that will tear human limbs apart more effectively. And the only response I have to it is this podcast, is this sense of meditation that becomes prayer, where in your stillness you can say, may the light of heaven be with them. And that within your own tradition, whatever your religion is, that you can use it to create this dynamic of prayerfully remembering them, the living and the dead. May the light of heaven be with everybody in your life that has passed away. May you know that they are just beyond your fingertips, and that they can step into the present moment with you in memory. And your heart can open as you wish them peace and the light of heaven to be shining on them forever. Thank you for being here. Bye-bye.